force them to enact legislation abolishing Bantu education and to address a myriad of other black grievances. The loud silence of the white electorate turned many black moderates into radicals and radicals into revolutionaries. I had rumors daily that there would soon be an insurrection of black masses throughout the country, that the ANC was secretly organizing peasant armies to overthrow the regime, that soon the streets would run red with blood, white people's blood. Among my friends, there was persistent talk of leaving the country and joining the ANC's revolutionary wing, Umkhonto weSizwe, Spear of the Nation, then coming back armed with bazookas and grenades to fight whites to the death. The idea of becoming a freedom fighter appealed to me. Now that doubts about the efficacy of nonviolence had been proved true. The more I saw blacks killed by policemen, the more revolutionary I became. South Africa will soon be free, I vowed. And I will help set her free. There was a man named Ngwenya in our yard. He was from Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe and Joshua Nkomo were fighting a guerrilla war to overthrow the white minority rule of Ian Smith. Several of Ngwenya's relatives were freedom fighters in the Patriotic Front, and I visited him one evening to find out more about revolutionary fighting. We had been talking for a while when I finally declared, "I want to become a freedom fighter." "What kind of freedom fighter?" Ngwenya inquired. "The one in the bush, with a gun, killing whites," I said. "To be honest with you," he said, "I can't imagine you with a gun, let alone killing anybody. You love tennis and books too much. One becomes a guerrilla fighter when one sacrifices everything for the gun." "I can do that to bring an end to apartheid." "Even if you could sacrifice everything," he said, "which I don't doubt you can do, I still think guerrilla fighting is not for you." "It is for me," I said with the impetuosity of youth. "Can you sacrifice even your tennis and books?" he said with a wry smile. "You know, there are no tennis courts or libraries in the jungle, only swamps and thickets. In guerrilla fighting, you are trained not to make friends with white tennis players, but to kill them. When under fire, there's no time of dreaming of someday going to America." "Can you live such a life?" "Yes," I said impulsively. As we talked, tear gas began seeping in through a hole in the door and cracks in the windows. And Mrs. Ngwenya, who all along had been sitting by the coal stove, patching her five children's rags, silently stood up, wetted some rags, woke her six-month-old baby up, and began daubing its mouth with the soaked rag to stop it from choking with tear gas. "This has been happening every night since the riots began," Mr. Ngwenya said bitterly, as he awakened the rest of the children, ranging in age from 3 to 10. "I helped him prepare soaked rags for them. From experience, I knew that no one could sleep when the police engulfed the ghetto with tear gas at night to keep blacks off the streets. The method worked, but black families paid a heavy price and children were hardest hit. There had already been several tear gas-related deaths." "Before I left," Mr. Ngwenya said, "there's room for people with your brains in the struggle. Your kind fight on a different front. Teachers and doctors and lawyers are needed to care for the wounded, defend political prisoners, and teach the masses about freedom. Writers are also needed to tell the rest of the world what the struggle is all about. So you see, you don't need only a gun to fight against apartheid. There are many roads that lead to Rome. Think about using your talents in the struggle." Police power had been so relentlessly and ruthlessly applied, that when October rolled around, the rebellion had been largely contained. Only a few pockets of sporadic violence remained. Hundreds of black clergymen, journalists, civil rights activists, teachers, lawyers, students, and anyone suspected of subversive acts had been detained. Thousands of black students had fled the country to escape arrest. The official death toll in the 4 months of violence stood at about 400. The unofficial figure was twice that. After a few meetings with puppet black leaders, genuine leaders were languishing in jails under indefinite detention. The government announced that it was no longer mandatory for black schools to teach in Afrikaans. So instead of taking the first step toward improving education in black schools by abolishing the hated language, the government was offering flimsy excuses why in some cases the language had to be learned. The trend of the future is towards the complete Africanization of South African society. So it will be to everyone's benefit to learn Afrikaans. After puppet black leaders had ratified the Afrikaans Compromise, after the government had crushed with its awesome military might the various black movements that had sought to bring about fundamental reform in Bantu education, the government ordered black schools reopened. But few school buildings had survived the rebellion. Fewer students returned to classes. Many had been killed, many had fled the country, many were in detention, and many were simply afraid to enter a classroom for fear that the police would take them away. I returned to school, but found it impossible to study. After almost 6 months without schooling, my enthusiasm for learning had been dampened. Besides, I felt, as did many other students, that with Bantu education, the source of all the violence, still in place, there was no point in learning. What did we fight for? What did many of us die for? Was the common feeling among students. Of the few who did return to school, most soon left to seek work. Some girls were forced to leave, for they had become pregnant during the rebellion. Morale among teachers was low. Some became the object of hate for allegedly acting as informers and providing police with lists of student leaders. One teacher offered this flimsy excuse for his treachery. Because of repeated threats by the police to arrest and kill all students, including innocent ones, we, traitors, provided them with lists of student leaders to prevent a massacre. What's better? A few dozens of you in jail, or all of you dead? We would have preferred death. Chapter 44. The reopening of schools led to an easing of government restrictions on black travel into white neighborhoods. And I was able to visit the ranch for the first time in 2 months. It was an early Tuesday morning, cloudy and windy. The black bus to Pretoria dropped me right in front of the ranch. And as I came up the sloping driveway leading to the clubhouse, I saw Wilfred just leaving the tennis court following a lesson with a short, blonde white woman in a blue and white Adidas warm-up. At first, Wilfred didn't recognize me. But when he did, his eyes behind a pair of gold-rimmed glasses popped out. "Main hot," he cried, as if seeing a ghost. "Look who's here. Mark! So you're still alive?" I nodded and smiled. Wilfred and the white woman were standing on a patch of freshly mown grass in front of the first of four all-weather tennis courts, whose surface was strewn with Dunlop tennis balls. Wilfred said something in German to the white woman. She smiled and greeted me in a soft voice with a German accent. "Wilfred, wriggling into his white Adidas sweater, said to me, "Can you please pick up the balls and take them with you to the clubhouse? I'll be with you in a minute." He accompanied the white woman to her car, a snow-white Mercedes-Benz of the latest style. I hurriedly picked up the balls and then headed for the clubhouse, where I gulped two large glasses of ginger ale and munched several scones, having left home without eating breakfast, while reading the Rand Daily Mail, whose front page was filled with stories of continued violence in ghettos around the country. Minutes later, Wilfred entered, a smile on his face. "So," he said, taking a bottle of Kronenbräu beer out of the fridge, "how did you manage to stay alive? You haven't been here in so long that we feared something must have happened to you. The newspapers were full of stories of violence and killings and arrests in the townships. I understand Alexandra was one of the hardest hit areas." I said yes, and proceeded to recount the nightmare of the past 2 months. Wilfred listened sullenly. When I ended, he shook his head in disbelief and muttered a curse in German. "But how could the police and army do such things?" he asked angrily. "I don't know," I sighed. "You know, we whites have never heard about the atrocities you've just described. What I can't understand is why the bloody government would go on the air each night and say everything was under control, that the few communists responsible for starting the riots were being efficiently rounded up and black life was returning to normal, when in fact the police and army were shooting down innocent people. It was clear why news about unrest was censored. The government didn't want whites to panic, or the rest of the world to know about police excesses in dealing with unarmed protesters. While the liberal English papers strove for more detailed coverage despite the censorship, by sending their black reporters into the ghettos, the pro-government Afrikaans papers churned out successive scathing editorials and commentaries deploring the damage to government property, the intimidation of black workers and the murders of black policemen, mayors and other collaborators with the system, claiming that the ghettos were in danger of disintegrating into anarchy instigated by the ANC. The Afrikaans papers urged the government to use maximum force to restore law and order. The ANC, they claimed, was a terroristic communist movement out of touch with the aspirations of blacks, who were perfectly satisfied with the way things were. They then called on all responsible and law-abiding blacks to help the government thwart attempts to turn South Africa, a Christian, civilized, peace-loving, multinational democracy, into a Russian satellite. The horrors of African nations under the throes of communism were graphically spelled out. Mass starvation, coups and counter-coups, mass murders, high infant mortality rates, torture for political dissidents, draconian laws allowing for any opponent of the system to be arrested without charges and detained without trial. "Mark," Wilfred said, "everybody will be in the bar tonight. After playing, will you come and tell them the things you've just told me?" "Wilfred," I said, "you're not offended by the truth because you have an open mind. But many whites are not like you. They don't want to hear the truth, especially how a black man says it. You see, I feel so emotional about what the police and the government are doing to my people that I can't lie for the sake of easing the consciences of white people. The only way I can tell it is like it is." "I want you to tell it like it is," Wilfred said, "the truth. Don't worry about how it will be received. I'll take care of anything that comes up. I give you my word." I served hundreds of tennis balls and hit more against the wall till about 6, then went to the bar. The place was stuffed with animated white faces. Except for 2 female servants who shuttled between the kitchen and the bar, I was to be the only black. Wilfred stood behind the counter, serving gin, whiskey, bourbon, Bloody Marys, and Kronenbrau beer. The stereo at the far end of the counter blared popular tunes. White men and women drank, chain-smoked, munched pretzels and other eatables, gossiped eagerly, and played darts. As I walked in, damp with sweat, all activity ceased. People drifted toward tables. I sat on a bar stool near the counter facing everybody. Someone bought me a large glass of ginger ale. From behind the counter, Wilfred said, "You all know Mark here? He's going to tell us the truth about what is going on in the townships, and will answer any questions." "Go on, Mark." I held back nothing. The effect was tremendous. White women gasped and sickened. White men shook their heads. Some grinned. The questions came. "But why do you burn your own schools and clinics and kill your own people?" asked a short, stocky German named Hans. "It's senseless." "First of all," I said, "it's the police who do most of the killing. Second of all, because the army has sealed off your areas, we can't get at you and kill you, at your property and burn it. We would dearly want to do that. So for the time being, till we devise ways of reaching you, symbols of oppression and collaborators with the system are convenient and necessary targets of our hatred and anger." Every face stared at me. For a moment, I thought I had overstepped my limits. But I felt that if it was the truth they wanted, I had to give it to them in its bleeding nakedness. "Was Afrikaans the sole cause of the riots?" asked an English liberal named St. Croix. "What we black students did on June 16 was not riot," I said. "We spontaneously rebelled against an education system designed to make us slaves. And black education is not the only thing that's wrong in this country. Afrikaans was merely the spark that set off a time bomb that's been ticking all these years that we blacks have been living as fourth-class citizens. We black youths feel the same bitterness and anger and hatred that our parents feel. But unlike them, we are not prepared to perpetually turn the other cheek, to smile and to say, 'Yes, boss, yes, madam,' while our humanity is being trampled to fragments. We've realized that our freedom will not come from a white man's change of heart. We have to fight for our rights." "What you're saying contradicts what I see and hear every day in my company," said Siegfried, a tall, bald-headed German who worked as senior manager for a large German electronics company in Johannesburg. "I meet well-educated and happy blacks who tell me with great warmth and eloquence how conditions are improving in the townships. They show me pictures of beautiful homes with swimming pools, double garages, lawns, and flower beds. Some of these houses, I must say, are fancier than white people's. So where does all this anger and bitterness come from?" "You've just described the elite black middle class," I said. "A hopelessly small minority whose aspirations are no different from those of the white men. Many of them make money any way they can so they can live comfortably. The fact of the matter is that the majority of blacks are peasants. They live in shacks and mud houses. They walk barefoot on dead streets strewn with rocks and broken bottles. Their infants often die of malnutrition. Their children's growth is stunted. For them, education and medical treatment are not free. They live in constant fear of running afoul of the degrading pass laws, of being deported to impoverished tribal reserves. Their lives tell a different story about apartheid, and please don't call ghettos townships. I paused. Across the stuffy bar, heads shook. All the time I had been talking, I had been unconscious of myself, of what I was saying. But now reality sunk in. Did you just say all that to white people? I asked myself. But something inside me told me that this was probably the only opportunity I'd ever have in this world to tell white South Africans the truth about black life. That gave me courage. What is it that black peasants want, then? Asked an Afrikaner with a scruffy red beard in soiled overalls. He was foreman at the Barrett's Tennis Court Construction Company. His responsibilities included supervising a large pool of cheap black labor. Plainly and simply put, we want to be free, I said. We want to be regarded as human beings in the land of our birth. And the present political system denies us that right. So it has to go? He said with a sinister grin. Yes. What would take its place? Democracy. Don't we have that already? No. So you want one man, one vote? Yes. To rule over us white people, is that it? He said. To make us slaves? No, I said. We blacks are not in the least interested in making slaves out of you. We simply want a country where race and color don't determine your place in the sun. We want a South Africa where everyone, black, colored, white, and Indian, is equal before the law. We want to live in peace with everyone as a nation united. Since when did blacks want to live peacefully with whites? He asked. You are our eternal enemies. God created us that way. Centuries ago, we tried to civilize you, to convert you from pagan savages into Christ-loving human beings. And how did you react? You slaughtered us and ate our missionaries. Since the days of Jan van Riebeeck, your bloodthirsty chiefs have sought to exterminate us, to drive us back into the sea, as you're fond of saying. So why shouldn't we defend ourselves? Why shouldn't we fight to preserve our white culture? God had a mission for us when he put us here long before you blacks ever reached here from Central Africa. And it is his will that we survive, that we keep alive the flame of Western civilization in this dark continent ruled by religions of the Antichrist. And God's given us apartheid as a way of ensuring our survival as a pure Christian race. I don't want colored grandchildren. He was getting angry. I could sense it. Were he alone with me, he would have taught the cheeky, bloody Kaffir a lesson. Half my mind told me to cool it, to acquiesce to his claims of racial superiority and predestination. I could not. The African in me refused to be told Africa was not my home. We blacks haven't the slightest desire to drive you back into the sea, I said, measuring each word carefully. South Africa is as much our country as it is yours. We can and must learn to live together. We need each other, not as master and servant, but as equals. There's room for everyone in this beloved country. Murmurs of approval rippled through the dimly lit bar. I gazed through the misty window. Night shrouded the place. My eyes darted about the bar and saw confused smiles. Smiles that seemed to say, "That's the truth, we agree. But why tell us?" More questions were asked about black life and the likely future of the country. I answered them without difficulty, with confidence. The barroom crowd dispersed. I was offered a lift all the way to First Avenue by St. Croix. Hardly a week after black schools reopened, units of the police and the army started raiding classrooms, arresting students. Every student was suspect. It became clear that the safest place to be was anywhere but school. I stopped going. The homes of students were also raided. I began spending entire days at the Barrett's Tennis Ranch, playing tennis and reading to keep up with my schoolwork, so that when it finally was safe to return to school, I wouldn't have lagged too far behind. One Tuesday at midday, I was reading some poems by Shelley when a beat-up orange Volkswagen stopped in front of the lake near the entrance gate, where I often had my lunch, and a short, brown-haired, bespectacled white man with a barrel chest stepped out. He was flashily dressed in a brand-new Fila tennis outfit, which fitted rather tightly. He held in one arm a stuffed Adidas duffel bag. In the other, three head tennis rackets, the Arthur Ashe competition model. "Hello," he said with a German accent. "You must be Mark." "Hi, yes," I said, rising to shake his small, hairy hand. "I'm Helmut," he smiled, twinkling his eyes. "Wilfred told me a lot about you. He said you're a very good player and practice every day. I've just joined the ranch and hope to play every day too. Maybe sometimes we can play together. I live in Hillbrow. I can sometimes give you a lift home." "Sure, we can play together," I said eagerly. "But I'm not that good a player." Wilfred inflated my tennis abilities. From his clothes, three expensive rackets, mean and well-conditioned body, I took him for a professional player. We sat down. He told me he was from a small town in Germany, but had been in South Africa a couple months, working for a German company. He had come intending to stay in South Africa, but now had second thoughts, because he now had seen the truth about apartheid. When he started talking about apartheid, I immediately was on guard. Could he be an undercover agent from BOS, Bureau of State Security, sent following my speech in the bar? "When my contract expires," he went on, "I'm going back to Germany. I couldn't live as a white man in this country for as long as those cruel, racist laws which oppress your people are still in place." Somehow he struck me as sincere. I decided to take the risk of talking freely, candidly, about the racial issue. I briefly told him about my life, my convictions, my dreams. "Keep playing tennis and studying," he urged, "and someday you will get to America. If there's anything I can help you with, books, money, anything, just let me know, and we'll talk about it." Once more, I had befriended a white man who didn't fit the stereotype. How many more of his kind were out there? Why were most blacks not meeting them? We agreed to play after lunch. After the first few games, I soon discovered that Helmut was a mere hacker. He huffed and puffed all over the court, ran around his backhand, double faulted God knows how many times. cursed himself for missing easy shots. After the match, which he lost 6-0, he said, "You're a much better player than I am. Obviously, you wouldn't improve much from playing with me. Do you still want us to play together?" Here was a white man asking me instead of ordering me. Yes, I would play with him. "And if you like," he said enthusiastically, "we can sometimes play at Ellis Park or other tennis courts in the city." "But that's against the law," I said. "To hell with the law," he said angrily. "I do what I want to do. I don't believe in apartheid laws, I told you. You're my friend. Just like any other white friend I have. Are you afraid?" "No." My friendship with Helmut proved an eye-opener. He followed through with his plans to have us flaunt the law and play on whites-only tennis courts in the city. Each time we did, white people stared at us as if we were aliens from outer space. Racist remarks were thrown at us. We made sure never to play at the same place twice in a row. Each time we drove about the city looking for a court, I thought a car followed us. I told Helmut about my uneasiness. "Let them follow us," he said nonchalantly. "What's our crime?" Yes, what was our crime? I became bolder and less worried about what might happen. After each playing session, we would cruise about Hillbrow, searching for restaurants where we could eat together. There were none. "We don't serve two colors here. Gafferus and white people cannot eat together here." Such remarks infuriated Helmut, and he would rail at the restaurant owners and call them bigots. The latter would simply smile, quietly pick up the phone and threaten to call the police. And we would leave. "Someday these bastards are going to get what's coming to them," Helmut would say after each row. "There's going to be a revolution in this country." "You're a brave German," I said. "There's no bravery about it," he said. "It's just plain common sense. Whites in this bloody country lack common sense. Can they accept the fact, the unavoidable reality, that someday you people are going to rule this country? You outnumber them 5-1. Why are they so blind, so stubborn? Can't they see that by continuing this barbarism called apartheid, they're simply making it impossible for this whole mess to be resolved peacefully? How can you blacks forgive them if this racism goes on much longer? Can't they see? Can't they see?" he said with strained hands, as if shaking an invisible foe. "They refuse to see," I said. "What utter madness," he cried. "You know," he clutched my arm anxiously, "this whole thing reminds me of what Hitler did to my country. His madness has left us Germans with a feeling of guilt and shame that can never go away. The very same forces of racial superiority of that idiot and madman I see at work right here. There could yet be another Holocaust in the world." I didn't know what the Holocaust was. "I'll tell you all about it when we get back to my flat." Helmut's apartment was on the fourth floor of a high-rise building overlooking Joubert Park. It was carpeted, handsomely furnished, and had a balcony. Despite my protests about the risks involved in sitting together on a balcony in a crowded section of Johannesburg, Helmut insisted we have our lunch of tuna fish sandwiches and toast salad there. He began telling me about Hitler's Germany, about the concentration camps, about the ovens and the gas chambers. I felt sick. "Why could the German people let this happen?" I said. "You say the rest of the world knew Why didn't they stop it? The answer to both your questions is simple and right here, said Helmut. Doesn't the rest of the world know about the suffering and deaths caused by apartheid? Aren't white South Africans aware of the oppressive nature of the regime they always vote for? You know, I said, with the voice of someone who has just put two and two together. I think a Holocaust is taking place right now in this country. There are no gas chambers or ovens this time, but black people are dying by the tens of thousands. Just look at the black infant mortality rate. This country has the best medical facilities in the world. Christian Barnard performed the first heart transplant right here. It exports food, but just look at the government's homeland policies of breaking up families and cutting women and children to deserts where there's no food. And what are homelands if not open-air concentration camps? Just look at the murder rate in the ghettos. Because people aren't allowed to work without permits and passes, they kill each other in order to survive. And finally, just look at what is happening to the black man's mind. Loss of self-esteem, apathy, mental illness. What does all that add to? Genocide. Helmut nodded. That's why I can't stay in this country, he said. Black people often saw me playing tennis with Helmut, or traveling in a car with him while sitting in the front seat. And their suspicion about my being an Uncle Tom mounted. From time to time, Helmut drove me home, without a permit. They can arrest me if they want, he said. The more black people saw us together, the more they called me a traitor to the struggle and vowed to deal with me the same way they dealt with black informants, police and other collaborators with the system. Death. I tried to explain that the whites I associated with were sympathetic to the black man's struggle, but was told that there was no such white man in South Africa. I was in a dilemma. Should I end my association with whites and preserve my life? Or should I risk it for what I believed, namely that whites were not monolithic, not all racists to be hated and destroyed? I chose the latter. My close friendship with Helmut led me to confide in him about my dilemma. He was sympathetic. If there's anything I can do to help you, he said one afternoon, please let me know. I'm your friend. I'd even risk my life for you. I know you may not believe me, but I'm serious. I don't see you as a black man, but as another human being, with the same needs, feelings, and dreams as any white man. One afternoon, following a morning of fierce rioting in Alexandria, Helmut offered to drive me all the way home. It was his day off, and we had been playing tennis at Ellis Park. Don't be silly, I said to him. They'll kill you. Even if I'm with you? Especially if you're with me, I said. But it's still daylight. It doesn't matter, I said. People will just watch you being hacked to death and put to flames. Besides, you don't have a permit to enter Alexandria. To hell with a permit, he said. I'm going in with you today. You must be mad, I said. They'll skin you alive. I'm going in, he insisted. My Volkswagen is sturdy and fast. If they come at me, I'll race away. What if you get stuck? Then I'll die like a true German. You're a brave man, I said. Dusk was creeping in. We drove along an uncrowded street that led from the highway into the northern part of Alexandra. Black children in rags were playing in mud puddles. Helma drove cautiously. We went into another street teeming with black men and women returning from work. Everywhere, people stared at us. He dropped me right at my door. I told him the shortest way out of the ghetto and wished him luck. On another day, at about 9 in the evening, Helmut dropped me on the outskirts of Alexandra following an afternoon of tennis at the ranch. He would have taken me home, but he had to rush to the airport to meet his girlfriend, who had just arrived from Germany. "Will you be all right?" he asked. "If not, I'll drive you all the way to 13th Avenue and go to the airport later. My girlfriend will understand." "Don't worry," I said. "I'll be fine. I know a shortcut home, even in this darkness." During the rioting, just about all of Alexandra's street lights had been smashed. The authorities hadn't bothered to repair them. The pitch darkness at night had led to a sharp increase in the murder rate. Helmut waited, car lights on, until I had disappeared down a narrow, twisting path that led into an unpaved street bordering Alexandra to the north. By keeping to this route, I hoped to reach home in about half the time it normally took on other streets. As I was in my white tennis outfit and sneakers, I jogged briskly down the dark road, praying that I didn't step into any potholes. I was halfway home when I came on a section of the street that still had one or two dim lights. I slowed down to catch a breath. I whistled softly to keep myself company. Suddenly, a group of about 10 shadowy figures leaped out of an abandoned building across from the street and surrounded me. "Don't panic," I told myself. One of the shadows spoke. "Back from another meeting with our oppressors, hey, Uncle Tom?" I recognized the owner of the disembodied voice. "What information did you give them this time?"
"I was only playing tennis," I said.
"Playing tennis with whites, huh?" Java said. "Aren't there any black tennis players in Alexandra? You think you are better than the rest of us, don't you?" I didn't answer. I trembled as the circle tightened around me. Since the riots broke out, Jarvis and his gang had increased their reign of terror. They robbed, raped, assaulted, and murdered. As I watched them close in on me, I could see that they were armed with knives, tomahawks, and machetes. I had to act quickly.
"Listen, Jarvis," I pleaded.
"If you want me to stop playing tennis with whites, I'll do so right this minute." Jarvis laughed fiendishly.
"Hear him now," he said. "He's been warned many times, and it's only now that he believes we mean business. Smart guy, hey?
Let's teach him a lesson," said one of Jarvis's cohorts. "Let's make sure he never plays tennis again." My mind went into a frenzy. I was completely surrounded. There seemed to be no escape. I could see my life slipping away. I thought of a million things I had done and a million things I still wanted to do. I prayed. Jarvis and his gang had just about reached me when suddenly down the street a truck with glaring headlights came racing down. Jarvis and his gang jumped to the sides of the street to make way. I saw salvation. Like a bullet, I shot through the opening.
"Get him!" the cry went up. "Don't let him escape!" With my speed, I knew that once I made it through the hole, no one on earth could catch me.
I was nearly out of the hole when something heavy struck my face. I staggered but regained control. Someone had hit me with a brickbat. Pain engulfed my face, but I raced on.
Get him! Don't let him escape!
But I was gone. The truck passed me. Jarvis and his gang were racing after me down the street. Like a well-trained thoroughbred, I steadily pulled away from the pack. Even after the chase had stopped, I continued running, slowing down only when I sighted home. I felt my face. It was bruised and swollen. I spat the blood that had filled my mouth. I noticed that one of my front teeth was missing. I entered the house and found my mother busy ironing my brother's school pants. Several of my sisters were huddled near the stove doing their homework.
Good Lord!
My mother gasped as she noticed how I looked.
What happened?
Nothing, I mumbled between swollen lips.
Nothing?
She exclaimed, coming over to where I stood.
Look at all that blood on your tennis shirt and pants.
I fell, I said. I was running and I tripped and fell. The street was full of rocks and potholes. Better come up with a better story, my mother said as she poured hot water into the bathtub. I grabbed a rag, immersed it in the hot water, and started daubing the swollen side of my face.
Since when did you fall and smash your face up like that?
She asked. Reluctantly, I told her what had happened. She turned pale and was silent for a long while, deep in thought. She ran her eyes up and down me.
I warned you, child, she said finally, in a sort of broken voice, that your white friends were going to get you into trouble. Why wouldn't you listen?
But what's wrong about having white friends? I asked. They're people too, aren't they? Why won't anyone believe me when I say that the white people I play tennis with are not racist?
They're on our side, Mama. They believe what we believe. They're fighting for what we are fighting for, an end to apartheid. So why shouldn't we judge them differently from the racist whites?
You know the answer to that, my mother said.
No, I don't, I said brusquely. To the black men and women in the streets, all whites are the same. All they know is the white man who's making their lives hell and whom they hate so much they would kill at the first opportunity.
Look at your father. He hates all white people. So when you come along and tell blacks like him of good white people, they immediately think you are a traitor.
So be careful, child. Black people are too angry, too desperate.
I woke up at dawn one morning, a few weeks following my brush with death. Stood with some friends on the veranda of a gutted Chinaman's shop and stared at clouds from burning buildings and vehicles in the distance. There was scattered gunfire. Army helicopters whirred above the township. Word circulated that armored police cars had cordoned the ghetto once more. It's June 16 all over again, someone said. Everyone nodded. Suddenly, from out of one of the yards that acted as a shortcut between 12th and 13th Avenues, emerged a group of youths lugging boxes of canned fish, bags of sugar and malt, loaves of brown bread, sacks of flour and maize meal and other eatables. I immediately recognized the stuff as the rations that the authorities, under a new welfare program, gave to elderly persons, many of whom suffered from TB and had no children to look after them.
Is that stuff from the stadium, men?
One of my friends asked the looters.
Yes, there's tons of it, man. Those rooms were loaded.
How did you guys manage to break down the walls?
The room where the food was stored was as impregnable as a fort. All through the riots, people had tried to break in. But the concrete walls and thick iron doors had refused to yield.
The stadium also housed the only public library in the township. Someone stole a bus and rammed it through the walls. Where were the police? The police are trying to put out a fire at the colored school. The colored students in Alexandra had till now refused to participate in the school boycott, claiming that they were not being taught Bantu education. Though colored education was compulsory and slightly better than Bantu education, it still qualified colors for third-class citizenship, behind whites and Indians. I greeted the news of their gutted school with glee. That was bound to jolt them back to reality, I thought, and convince them that they had no choice but to side with blacks in the struggle. What happened to the library? I asked. Who's got time to worry about books when there's plenty of free food? So the books are still there? I asked, salivating at the thought of finally possessing all those classics I had read on many a visit to the library. They're not only there, brother, they're burning, came the reply, punctuated by laughter. Someone thought it a mighty fine idea to destroy all traces of Bantu education and white oppression. But those books had nothing to do with Bantu education, I protested. I could picture going up in flames copies of Dickens, Stevenson, Zola, Doyle, Shakespeare, and many others. Donations by white liberals appalled by the state of black education. In my mind's eye, I saw reduced to soot all those wonderful books, which had revealed to me other ways of living, which had sustained me in a world of degradation. How long has it been burning? I asked in a downcast voice. Since dawn, was the answer. When we left, the flames were still confined to the west wing of the building. I raced off to the burning library, thinking I might, if lucky, be in time to salvage a few books. I took shortcuts, crossed dead streets strewn with charred vehicles, putrid garbage and rotting dogs. A few blocks from the building, I met a group of men, women and children lugging loot from the welfare office. As I neared the building, thought of the burning books, I felt angry. Why burn the only things that taught one to believe in the future? To fight for one's right to live in freedom and dignity. I found the place deserted. The bus was still lodged inside the welfare office's walls, smoldering. A pack of mongrels nearby licked crushed cans of pilchard. A small rag doll covered with what looked like blood was trapped under one of the bus's front wheels. I forced my way through the rubble toward what remained of the library. There, the fire had almost died down. Only wisps of grayish-blue smoke floated like ghosts into the hot air. The floor of the charred library was still hot, so I doused my feet in water from a broken pipe nearby, filled a large tin can with water and scattered it in my path as I walked gingerly about the scorched library, overturning metal shelves to see if any books had escaped the flames. I upturned about 5 shelves. All revealed the charred remains of classic books. My heart sank. I muttered oaths under my breath. I upturned more shelves, found nothing, and was about to leave when the urge to turn over all shelves overtook me. By the 3rd or 4th shelf, my eyes popped out. Books! Underneath were rows of books that not a flame had touched. Overjoyed, I quickly removed and stacked them in crude piles next to a ditch nearby. While thus engaged, I heard a rumble of trucks in the distance. I paid little attention. The rumble came nearer and nearer. I looked up and through a broken window in one of the library's blackened walls, I saw 2 army trucks enter the stadium through a fallen gate. Immediately, camouflaged white soldiers, about a dozen of them, jumped off the back of the trucks, machine guns in hand, and raced every which way. Some headed for the bus, others for the welfare office. Three came straight at me. "Don't panic," I told myself. "Don't panic." I stole into the ditch, taking the piles of books with me. The shadows of clumps of tall reeds alongside the ditch darkened it in spots. I crawled into one. My heart thumped in my throat. A thousand questions flitted across my mind. "Why did you come here?" I repeatedly asked myself. It seemed ironic that the very love for books that had nourished my dreams of a better life was about to shatter them. "Hier die Kafferkenners as mal." "These Kaffer children are lunatics," a voice said loudly. "Kijk net wat doen helle met boeken. Onze geld. Just look at what they've done to books, our money. I sure hope the government lets them go for years without another library," another voice said in Afrikaans, amid sulfurous oaths. "That'll teach them a lesson, the uncivilized bastards. If they only knew what suffering their black brothers and sisters are going through in the rest of Africa, they would be thankful of what we give them. They are the best treated blacks in the world." The voices sounded nearby, but I dared not lift up my head. What if they searched the ditch? I would be killed on the spot, no doubt about that. I wouldn't be the first they had murdered. I would be just another Kaffer killed while burning and looting government property. I don't know how many times I prayed to God and my ancestors for protection. I hugged one book to my breast. I thought of my family, of all the things I still wanted to do in this world. I must have been down in the ditch close to half an hour, still as a mouse. At length, I heard the trucks leave. I didn't come up immediately, fearing that guards may have been posted about the place. Satisfied there were no unusual sounds above me, I crawled on my stomach along the length of the ditch, which led outside the stadium on 12th Avenue. I left the books behind, planning to pick them up later. At home, I found everyone feasting on Saldanha pilchards and brown bread. "Did you get the stuff from the welfare office?" I asked my mother. "Yes," she said. "I was on my way back from Granny's when I saw people breaking into the building. I joined them. Now we have food to last us a while." "I just came back from there," I said. She asked me if I had seen the bus. "Yes. A little girl was crushed underneath one of the wheels as she was helping her mother drag a box of canned beans." I recalled the bloodied rag doll. That afternoon, my brother and I went to pick up the books.
Chapter 45. Despite sporadic unrest in the ghettos, the Black Southern Transvaal Lawn Tennis Association announced that trials will be held in Soweto to select a 10-player junior team to take part in the annual National Junior Tennis Championships in Atteridgeville, Pretoria. The announcement came in May. Black schools in Tembisa and Alexandra were still closed by government decree. I was able to practice 6 hours a day at the ranch. I made the team, but soon thereafter, it was announced that the July championships might be scrapped because the government was leery of hundreds of black youths from all over South Africa gathering in Atteridgeville, so near to white suburbs of Pretoria. I was disappointed. I talked the matter over with Scaramouche, who, since I made the team, had been working out with me. "Don't take it too hard," he said. "There's still a chance
that the championships might be held. Even if they're not, there'll be other opportunities for you to compete. There are a few black tournaments coming up, and I'll enter you in singles and we can team up for doubles. Also, it's about time I introduced you to Andre Zietzmann, a white friend of mine who is one of the best tennis players in the country. He's a liberal and just returned from America, where he's been on a tennis scholarship. He's a lefty like you, and I think you'll find him helpful. I looked forward to meeting this Andre Zietzmann. Having just returned from America, I thought, he might help me contact universities over there about the possibility of a tennis scholarship. There was a lull in the unrest. The government gave the go-ahead that the tournament take place. The tennis facilities in Attridgeville were better than in other ghettos, but still distantly inferior to those of whites. The team of 5 boys and 5 girls was housed in various homes throughout the township. There wasn't enough sponsorship money to pay for hotel accommodations. There were no hotels in Attridgeville. The level of tennis among us black was still appalling, but we had a good time. Often we talked about politics, the protests, and the need for black solidarity. Southern Transvaal again won the team competition. At the same time that the tournament was taking place, thousands of miles away at Wimbledon, England, Arthur Ashe was blazing his way to the finals. His exploits were closely followed in the daily newspapers like The Star and Ren Daily Mail, which had extensive coverage of Wimbledon. One Sunday morning, the entire world awoke to a tennis miracle. Arthur Ashe had won Wimbledon. Pandemonium broke out in the streets of Attridgeville. Blacks everywhere were brandishing newspapers with the headline, "Ashe paints Wimbledon black." Every black man, woman, and child felt proud. We had achieved the ultimate triumph in a white man's sport. We could, if given the opportunity, compete with and beat the best in the world. Everyone at our championship tournament had wanted to become Arthur Ashe. Spectacular matches were played that day. I became more determined than ever to get to America. At the end of the tournament, I returned to Alexandra inspired. I immediately set out to strengthen my ties with white tennis players, intent on using them to improve my game and to find out more about how a black boy from the ghetto could win a scholarship to an American university. I remained mindless of the dangers of associating with whites. Schools reopened in August. I enrolled, hoping to complete my first year of matriculation. Luckily, Simba Quicks was still willing to underwrite my expenses, and I was able to continue playing tennis each afternoon, instead of being out working to pay my way through school. My school friends had by now almost all disappeared, victims of arrests and detentions without trial or killings. Or they had fled along with the thousands of black youths who were daily fleeing the country since the eruption of June 16, and the police crackdowns that followed. Many of those who fled were reportedly undergoing guerrilla training in neighboring black states under the aegis of Umkhonto we Sizwe. Some of these youths were beginning to infiltrate back into the country in sorties, armed with submachine guns, bombs, and other sophisticated weapons. Power stations and various government buildings were blown up. Whites feared the beginning of urban guerrilla war. They purchased guns, burglar alarms, rifles, and guard dogs in unprecedented quantities. More repressive laws designed to suppress black anger sailed through Parliament with little opposition. More black informants were recruited to report on events in the ghettos. There was talk that 1 out of every 10 blacks in the ghetto was an informant.
armed and camouflaged soldiers would from time to time burst into classrooms, interrupting lessons to read off lists of those suspected of subversive activities, rounding them up in armored vehicles, headed for unknown destinations. Sometimes, plainclothes black policemen from the special branch did the rounding up in flashy cars. Students were picked up who, to my knowledge, had never done anything subversive except call for an end to Bantu education. Would I be picked up next? I wondered. I became paranoid. My health suffered, and learning became impossible.